From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Mourners have gathered at Staples Center to pay their respects to rapper-entrepreneur Nipsey Hussle. He was shot to death nearly 2 weeks ago in the parking lot of his Crenshaw District clothing store. Hussle's memorial's due to get underway shortly. We'll hear from those in the crowd and listeners wanting to add their tributes.
All my life, been grinding all my life. Sacrifice, hustle paid the price. Wanna slice, got to roll the dice, that's why. All my life, I've been grinding all my life. Look, all my life, been grinding all my life. Sacrifice, hustle paid the price.
Rapper, entrepreneur Nipsey Hussle, as Los Angeles plans to say goodbye this morning to a man who had a huge impact, not just in his Crenshaw District community, but throughout our region. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle at Staples Center right now. Thousands have gathered who've gone inside for an event that tickets went within the first 45 minutes. They were made available online. Some 20,000 people expected inside Staples for the memorial, which gets underway shortly. But many others have also gathered outside of Staples Center to pay their respects. There's also a crowd outside the Marathon clothing store. That's the shop that was operated by Hussle at the corner of Slauson and Crenshaw in the Crenshaw District. I want to open up the phones for those of you that are fans of Hussle's music, of his entrepreneurialism, his impact on the South Los Angeles community where he was raised, where he employed people in his store, and where he continued with his activism. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. There's also going to be a 25-mile procession with the hearse carrying the casket of Nipsey Hussle through the streets of Los Angeles, South L.A., Watts as well, Inglewood, all of that until its arrival at the Angeles Funeral Home, an institution in the Crenshaw District. 866-893-KPCC. With us, KPCC reporter Emily Elena Dugdale, who is outside Staples Center with mourners who have gathered to pay their respects. Emily, share with us how much of a crowd is gathered there right now.
Yeah, well, right now there are a couple hundred of people still outside the entrances. You know, they're letting people in through multiple entrances. This is definitely heavy security here, lots of fences. It's definitely a big operation. You know, there's a lot of people here who are from the neighborhood I talked to who are from South L.A. They came out here because they wanted to show support. But there's also people from all over the country, which is really cool to see that, you know, Nipsey Hussle's legacy didn't just impact the communities in which he lived and worked, but really all over the country.
Wow. So fans have traveled, in some cases, a great distance. I know they couldn't necessarily get tickets to go inside if they weren't California residents, because it was limited for locals to be able to go. Have you talked with people who've traveled cross-country for this?
Absolutely. You know, Larry, I'm actually standing here with Isaiah Weston. He and his cousin are here outside Staples Center. They came all the way from Philly. And I'm going to actually put Isaiah on the phone here for a little bit. He would love to talk about, you know, what Nipsey Hussle meant to him all the way out in Philly.
Isaiah, thank you. Good morning. We appreciate it. Obviously, his death had enough of an effect on you. You paid to buy a ticket to come out across country. Share with us what he meant to you.
Nipsey Hussle, he meant a lot to us all over the world, and definitely in Philadelphia. We all listened to his music all over. We all saw the things that he's done for his community, giving back the things that he was trying to do. And to find out a day before he was killed, he was supposed to have a meeting with the LAPD. Like, who does that for their community? Have set up meetings with the police to better the community. You never heard of that. And what Nipsey Hussle meant to us, I feel like Nipsey Hussle is the Meek Mill of L.A. And for us, if something never happened to Meek, we would react the same way. We would fly wherever to be by his side and just to support him and show our respect. So I feel like that's one of the main reasons we're out here, to show our respects to another genius, another black entrepreneur that just touched the people and the community in so many ways, not even by just his music, but just by the things that he's done in his life. He just, it's just amazing. And it's, you could talk about all his accomplishments forever, but he was just an amazing person.
Isaiah, you were just mentioning Meek Mill, who's the native of Philadelphia. And, you know, sort of speaks to the regional importance in rap when someone comes up in a community, whether it's Nipsey Hussle in Los Angeles, Meek Mill in Philly, that in rap, these artists really represent their communities and the specifics, the location of where they come from. And so for you as an East Coast resident, what is it about the Los Angeles that Nipsey Hussle wrote about, rapped about, that made him appealing even though you didn't live here?
What made him appealing, even though I didn't live here, like I said, I don't want to speak about Meek Mills because it's not about him, but I've got to watch him grow up. And I know there's tons of people like me in L.A. that watch Nipsey Hussle from nothing come all the way up to the top and give back to his community. So for me to see that, seeing that being done on the other side of the country, I just got to pay my respect to it. Even though I'm not going into the Staples Center, just being able to talk on the phone with you about Nipsey Hussle is just I'm just thankful to be able to speak about him. So,
Isaiah, thank you very much. I really appreciate your sharing about the effect of Nipsey Hussle's death and what prompted you to invest your time and your money and make such a trip. Thank you so much. We hope you have a good experience here in Los Angeles. Thank you. Isaiah, who traveled cross-country for this, Emily Elena Dugdale, KPCC reporter outside Staples Center, Isaiah Weston coming cross-country for this. Emily, are you there? Emily, are you there?
Hi, Larry.
Hi. Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable, this gentleman coming across country for this, just to be with other people who felt about Nipsey Hussle as he felt about it. Is the crowd there rather subdued, in a state of mourning, would you say, or is it more upbeat as people are thinking about celebrating his life?
You know, that's a good question. It definitely is pretty subdued. People are pretty quiet, but there's also, you know, there's also laughter. There's also a lot of hugging. People are recognizing each other, you know, friends or family, and they're hugging each other, embracing. You know, there's a few tears, but I really think that the name of the celebration of life, I really think that's true to the crowd right now. People are sad, but again, it's really to celebrate the accomplishments that Nipsey Hussle had in this community.
And again, if you're an Air Talk listener, maybe given what a presence he was in the community, maybe you knew him. You want to share a brief anecdote about Nipsey Hussle or a fan of his music. You wanted to just weigh in briefly and share your respects, your thoughts about his death. Again, it was over a week and a half ago. He was in the parking lot of the Marathon, his clothing store, which is in a strip mall in the Crenshaw District, when he was shot and killed. A suspect in the killing has been arrested, has been charged in that case. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Yvonne writes on the page, "I never listened to his music, but I completely respect the man and how he was working on bettering his community. It's such a shame that, some gang member would take a man's life like this. Tragic." Joaquin writes, "Nipsey is the type of guy that made America great and could make it great again. See CEOs used to live in Midwest blue-collar cities with their workers. They invested in their local schools and churches, built community centers, and sponsors parades and barbecues. Now executives live in a handful of coastal cities disconnected from the people they employ. They devote their time and philanthropy to elite institutions. Joaquin citing Nipsey Hussle as an example of that kind of, you know, grassroots community investment with the people that he grew up with. 866-893-KPCC if you want to weigh in and pay your respects. Again, Emily is outside Staples Center where a capacity crowd of mourners are there for the service, which is expected to get underway shortly. And last a couple of hours, the crowd outside Staples has grown considerably. I'm looking at the video feed, and it now looks like what earlier was just maybe a few hundred people is thousands deep. I'm looking at the outside the doors of Staples Center, and the crowd is backing up into the LA Live complex considerably. So more people have arrived, probably, you know, parking being somewhat challenging in the area. They have arrived to pay their respects. Also want to mention with that 25-mile long processional through South Los Angeles, Inglewood, Watts, all the way up to Angela's funeral home, that is going to mean streets are going to be absolutely jammed because individuals are going to be out along the streets to pay their respects as the procession continued. So just want to mention that, you know, that's something for you to pay attention to if you need to be driving anywhere in the downtown LA area from South Park District up through these other communities. You just need to keep it in mind. Mikoya, in Your Belinda said, I never listened to Nipsey's music, but being Ethiopian and he's Eritrean American, I really related to his experiences. That's Mikoya. Karen in Long Beach, good to have you with us. Your thoughts or memories about Nipsey Hussle?
Well, I'm an older white woman. And I had an office space next to him 10 years ago when he was just starting out. And he was nothing but warm and welcoming. I would hear his music and I'd come over. I was curious about what he was doing and who he was. And he was, you know, open to talking to me. And even when I saw him, you know, I saw him outside of the office area, happened to see him out, you know, on the street, and he called me mama and said, you know, how you doing? And he was just extremely warm.
Oh, that's so nice. Was he selling his mixtapes out of the trunk at that period, or had I guess we're 10 years ago, did he start to establish himself, build his profile at that point?
Yeah, I don't even know if he was at that point yet.
Okay.
Seemed like that to me. He was just working it out.
Just getting started. Karen, thank you for sharing that experience. I appreciate it very much. Ed, joining us from Oregon, thanks very much. Ed, your memories of Nipsey Hussle.
So I actually grew up right down the street. What used to be the Kershaw Ford, I used to actually just live right behind there. So
yeah, know that dealership well, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, my cousin was the one that put me onto Nipsey Hussle. You know, he was just a, you know, rapper from the area. And you could literally see him driving around the Crenshaw Street every weekend during car shows and stuff like that. And just to see, you know, that he made a really positive influence on people through his music and his acts. It's just, very, very touching. Very touching. And especially since, you know, he's from the area. And whatnot. It just almost feels like you're losing a family member, you know?
And that's understandable because, you know, Crenshaw is such a distinct community. And he's certainly not the first to give that community a voice, a sense of place, a sense of the cultural mix in Crenshaw, the African-American history in Los Angeles of that community. But he beautifully encapsulated not just, you know, what that community had been as it evolved, but the future of it and a vision for it going forward. And Ed, that's understandable. Someone who grew up there, that has great meaning to you.
Yeah, and just to see him doing really positive things in an area where, you know, not everyone is as lucky. I mean, I feel blessed, you know, to be honest, to be able to, you know, have a home and have a family outside of there. Because most of the people I grew up with were either, you know, doing illegal things, are in jail, or, you know, were murdered, or, you know, have no real future. And so to see him actually, you know, progressing through his career, positively affecting the community, you know, encouraging the arts, you know, it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, I hope this is, you know, opens people's eyes that there is more, you know, that you're not just trapped in the hood, and, you know, that there is a future out there for everybody. As long as you, you know, like his song says, as long as you're dedicated and you're, you know, put the preparation in, there is a future.
Yeah, Ed, I appreciate it so much. I love Karen's previous call, too, talking about when Nipsey was trying to get things going, you know, in terms of his music, his business, and you know, just, well, I guess that's how he got his nickname, because a friend who, making the play on words, the comedian Nipsey Russell, who did wordplay, but then the young Nipsey just, you know, hustling to try and find a way to establish himself and to build his voice. Ed, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us. Jack and Watt says, I think it's so important for our community to preserve what Nipsey Hussle did. Work needs to be carried on as a way for remembering him and helping the memory of Nipsey Hussle live on. Well, for the next couple of hours at Staples Center, that's what mourners are going to be doing, is memorializing him, and no doubt there will be a lot in what people say, in the performances that take place there, attempting to convey the vision that Nipsey Hussle had for the Crenshaw District, South Los Angeles generally, and what that vision is going to mean going forward. Silas, writing on the Air Talk page, says, I feel proud to be an Angeleno today. We'll continue to bring you the different textures, the flavors, the experiences outside Staples Center, and of course, as the procession from the arena continues through the streets of Los Angeles, Inglewood, and Watts as well. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC.
No worries.
Resist, resist. Maybe you heard that faintly in the background as Julian Assange of WikiLeaks was taken into custody today by authorities in London at the Ecuadorian embassy, as Ecuador decided today they would no longer provide diplomatic shield to Julian Assange, who was being charged in the United States with conspiring with Chelsea Manning to publicize classified American intelligence information. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, that audio courtesy of the Berlin-based international news agency, Reptly. With us to talk about the arrest of Assange, the charges that he could be facing should he be extradited to the U.S., London-based defense and diplomatic correspondent for the BBC, Jonathan Marcus. Jonathan, thank you for being with us. Had there been any telegraphing, any sort of word that Ecuador was going to make this move?
Yes, there was. It was quite well signaled. We didn't know, obviously, precisely which day it was going to happen. But I think for about a week, 10 days now, it's looked as though the Ecuadorian authorities' patience had worn thin. Of course, crucially, there's been a change of political regime in Ecuador, and that, I think, has been a key factor as well in the change of policy there towards Mr. Assange.
What did Ecuador say, if anything, about the reasons why he was now persona non grata at the embassy?
Well, I suppose, to put it colloquially, he wasn't a great house guest. You know, there's been a lot of controversy about him over the time, nearly 7 years now, that he's been locked away there, in a sense, through his own volition in the embassy, certainly isolated there. There have been all sorts of lurid tales about his personal hygiene, about his behavior, and so on and so forth. But I think the thing that really seems to have swung it for the new Ecuadorian authorities is the fact that they say that he was continuing to violate the conditions of his asylum scion there. Namely, he was carrying on his campaigning and political activities. And indeed, WikiLeaks, it suggested, was responsible for putting out some rather negative material about the leader of Ecuador as well. And that clearly didn't help Mr. Assange's case.
You mentioned you've been there for almost 7 years and authorities in the UK couldn't touch him because of that diplomatic protection. But he still apparently is going to fight extradition to the United States. Can you share with us any details about what's involved in that legal proceeding to potentially bring him to the U.S. to face charges?
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, it's going to be not so dissimilar to what happened all those years ago when he was accused in Sweden of a rape and a sexual assault. And the Swedes wanted to extradite him. Mr. Assange insisted that he was an innocent man, but he also insisted that he wasn't going to go back to Sweden because he feared that he would be extradited from there to the United States. So that eventually is what drove him into the Ecuadorian embassy. The extradition procedure and his appeals went through from layer to layer of the British, the English judicial process. Eventually, it looked as though Mr. Assange was going to be sent to Sweden, and at that point, he bolted for the Ecuadorian embassy. Clearly, now the Americans have laid charges against him. We think there may be other charges potentially coming, but the initial charge is a charge of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion, namely that he assisted Chelsea Manning to try and hack into an American intelligence database. The thing is that the British appear to have given an undertaking to the Ecuadorians that they won't send Mr. Assange to a country that has the death penalty. Now, there's no sense in which that particular charge would carry the death penalty. I'm told it carries a maximum sentence of about 5 years, but it's very hard to see quite what is going to happen now to square that circle between the apparent assurances that have been given to the Ecuadorians and obviously this very clear legal request from the American authorities that he be extradited to the United States.
Yeah, are the sexual assault allegations from Sweden, has that completely concluded, been dropped, and there's no legal effort there, or could that be revived? Do we know?
Well, I'm no expert on the Swedish legal system. I'm not actually an expert on anybody's legal system, I have to tell you. But, I mean, look, all we know is that one of the charges, the sexual assault charge, has expired because of the statute of limitation.
Okay.
The rape charge, which is more serious, has not expired, as I understand it. There were some reports in the media today saying that the lady in question and indeed her legal representative were looking into the whole issue of reviving that case. The case had essentially been put aside because the Swedish authorities basically took the view that there was no way they were going to get proper access to Mr. Assange to be able to pursue the inquiry. Yeah. So that may all now change. I mean, I suppose it's possible there could be a Swedish desire to see Mr. Assange back in their courts. But for the moment, anyway, the running is being made by the United States. Mr. Assange appeared in court today on a pretty open and shut case of skipping bail. He was found guilty on that, and he could be sentenced there to a year or so in prison, potentially. But obviously, over the next days and weeks, we're going to see the unfolding of this extradition process. Judges here will have to decide Mr. Assange's fate. And of course, as it goes from one level of the legal system to another, he will have the opportunity to appeal if it goes against him and go to a higher court. At least that's what one assumes. So I think we're not over with this saga quite yet.
Well, you may not be a legal expert. You just did a pretty good job of detailing the legal issues in multiple countries. I appreciate it. We're talking with Jonathan Marcus, London-based defense and diplomatic correspondent for the BBC, as we're talking about the arrest of Julian Assange of WikiLeaks in London today after the Ecuadorian embassy said they would no longer provide him with diplomatic protection. So authorities there in London took him into custody. The request for extradition to the United States being made by the U.S. Department of Justice. And let's talk a little bit more about the potential charges in the U.S., Jonathan. So the allegation here from the U.S. is that that Assange didn't just receive classified documents from Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning, but that he actually conspired with Manning to take that information?
Well, indeed. I mean, I suppose in layman's terms, and again, I'm very sensitive to the sort of legal niceties, but I mean, layman's terms, I suppose they're arguing that he was an accomplice of Chelsea Manning, that Chelsea Manning had come to him for some advice. Now, it doesn't seem to be a huge amount of advice from what has been made public already. There might be a lot more, you know, behind the scenes that we haven't yet seen. But in essence, he's charged with this conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. In other words, to try and help Chelsea Manning get into that secret database. It's kind of interesting, I think, that the Americans have tiptoed their way around the press freedom, the freedom of information issues, and have gone for this, I mean, you know, a serious charge, but not extraordinarily major charge. I mean, I understand if convicted, typically you would serve less than 5 years in prison in the United States, which is a considerable time, of course. But, you know, it looks as though, as I say, they've rather delicately kept away from the terrain of freedom of information and actually gone for this sort of criminal conspiracy, as it were, which is an interesting tack. Some reports, of course, in the United States, you're much closer to them than I am, suggest that other charges might follow as well.
I didn't realize also the expense that the British government took on with Assange being there. Apparently they had a full-time police presence outside the embassy there for most of the time that Assange was inside.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this was a huge irritant, a huge problem in bilateral relations between Ecuador and Britain, of course. As you say, there was a considerable cost in policing in a capital which has a host of other problems to deal with at the moment. In fact, I think latterly, I think some of that policing was actually removed because it was just considered that it was far too expensive to keep on with it. So it was an irritant. But one's got to be clear here, you know, for some people, and I think Mr. Assange is a man who divides the world very clearly. Some people see him, and he has some very loyal defenders, as a heroic warrior, information warrior, for information freedom, for unmasking, you know, the secrets of the rich and the powerful. Now, other people see him much more critical. They see him as a narcissist, a very strange individual, who, of course, has released large quantities of information, irrespective of what the consequences might be in some cases, and very much mindful of the consequences in other cases. I mean, WikiLeaks seems to have been a willing or unwilling dupe of the Russian intelligence services, who may well have hacked into the Democratic Party's emails in the United States in an effort to influence the US election campaign. Now, that's all very clear from the Mueller report. So, you know, he is a curious and rather flawed character, perhaps, though some people, as I say, see him as a great hero of the new information age.
I want to thank you so much, Jonathan. This has been very helpful to explain what happened very quickly this morning with the arrest of Julian Assange in London. Thanks so much for talking about what comes next, what may be a very protracted process.
Who knows? We may be speaking again.
I was gonna say,
who knows?
I wouldn't be surprised. Jonathan Marcus with us, the BBC's London-based defense and diplomatic correspondent, joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, the future of the National Enquirer. The owners of the publication looking at putting the tabloid on the market. There's a report that a Los Angeles area businessman who's a major Democratic Party contributor, is looking at acquiring the publication, which was such a voice for President Trump's candidacy a couple of years ago. The National Enquirer, tabloid journalism and its future, that to come up. But first time for a live update from Hetty Lynn Herdes. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Terrific to have you with us. We will continue to keep you updated throughout the program today on the latest as mourners gather to pay tribute to and to remember Nipsey Hussle, the rapper based in Los Angeles, entrepreneur who, with the Marathon clothing store, employed a lot of local individuals. We're going to have word as the procession leaves Staples Center later today to make its way rather circuitously, so different communities have a chance to come out for the procession before it finally ends up in the Crenshaw District at the Angelus Funeral Home. We continue our coverage on Air Talk today with the future of the National Enquirer. Yesterday, word came out that the parent company, American Media, is looking at selling the tabloid, this after all kinds of scrutiny of the Enquirer and legal problems in the wake of it purchasing a story from a former Playboy playmate about an alleged affair with Donald Trump, payment that was paid by the parent company of the Enquirer, and then the story was spiked. With us to talk about the latest, Rick Edmonds of Pointer, media business analyst and leader of news transformation at the Pointer Institute. Rick, good to have you with us.
Yeah, nice to be with you again, Larry.
So let's start, first of all, with what seems to be precipitating AMI's move to sell.
Yeah, well, the parent company, American Media, is largely owned by a hedge fund. Chatham owns a couple of other, has large interests in other publications. And the reports in both the Washington Post and New York Times, which I assume came pretty directly from that investor, is that short story, the Enquirer had become an embarrassment because of all that it was doing, and they wanted out.
All right. And the owner, Mr. Pecker, David J. Pecker,
right,
is a longtime friend, Donald Trump. And what sort of problems is he facing as a result of this purchase of the story that was spiked?
Well, I think that's sort of the final straw, if you will. And it's not a publication that's either financially successful or held in much esteem, and that's been progressive over 8 or 10 years. He may land on his feet, though. I think the story suggested, and there's been a later report, that he might be involved with another investor, and that would kind of keep him in business, though it would be broken off from the rest of the company.
The company made a deal with prosecutors identifying that $150,000 payment to Karen McDougal. It was claimed that was a political contribution made in violation of campaign finance law under a non-prosecution deal. American Media admitted that it made the payment to influence the election. And then as part of that agreement, which was signed last fall, American Media said that she'll commit no crimes whatsoever for 3 years, and that if it did, the company would thereafter be subject to prosecution for any federal criminal violation of which the federal government had knowledge. And then, of course, there was the controversy over claims by Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, that American Media had threatened to release compromising photos of him. He claims that the parent company was essentially extorting him over that, and that issue, of course, ongoing. Rick Edmonds, what's the state financially of tabloids? Because you've got TMZ with its, television programs, its website, you know, all of its breaking news related to tabloid subjects. Is there still a significant readership for the National Enquirer?
Well, good question. And I think the National Enquirer readership has been on a long slide. I saw in the stories this morning that they were 300,000, which is much below what they had been a year or two ago, and they're now around 200,000. So that's, for national publication, that's not much circulation. And as you mentioned with TMZ, I don't know all the figures on their audience, but they've been successful. They have a following. And, you know, that overall area of celebrity news with a little a tinge of expose and scandal hasn't disappeared from the American media scene. And there's still a market of people who like that. And, you know, if you want to go to a little bit more upbeat and respectable version of it, People is the most successful magazine in America right now. So some of what the tabloids have traditionally done is still news, but I think their print vehicle is kind of a shaky one for them.
You know, I have to say, though, at the supermarket where I go, everybody in the checkout line, you know, is caught by the headlines and the photos on the Enquirer. I still see people buy the hard copy of the Enquirer. There, you know, there's still clearly some degree of an audience, even though their circulation is down. Love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. If you are a guilty or unguilty reader of tabloids like the National Enquirer, I'd love to hear about it. I have to admit that I won't pick it up because it's just, you know, it's too embarrassing. But I do read it. I'll read what's on the front page of the Enquirer and its brethren publications as I'm standing in line to buy my groceries. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Maybe you got a family member or friend who's a loyal reader of the tabloids like the Enquirer. 866-893-5722. Norma writes on the page, every so often the Enquirer actually breaks important stories that no one else wants to touch. They broke the John Edwards affair story. You know, TMZ is really all celebrities. That's Norma's point. And Rick, that's something good to mention, because as I recall, a couple of employees of the Enquirer, didn't they camp outside John Edwards' place to try and get the goods on his affair?
Yeah, you have a couple things I think combined there. They were on the story. They reported different stages of it, and at one point they were getting ready to confront him, I think in a hotel, and he went and hid in the restroom. So you know, it had a very sort of a colorful cops and robbers and sort of a TV-like pursuit. The Enquirer had a big role also considerably earlier in the downfall of Gary Hart as a presidential candidate. And there were a couple different parts that it was the Miami Herald who staked out his house. But the Enquirer came up with a picture of him sitting with his alleged girlfriend on a yacht, the Monkey Business. And boy, that may have been the finishing touch for Gary Hart.
Well, and that was after he essentially challenged the media to, prove he was having an affair. And of course, they were up for that. We're talking with Rick Edmonds of the Poynter Institute, media business analyst and leader of News Transformation. We're talking about the tabloid news business, stories that the National Enquirer is up for sale, its parent company, wearing down with all the tabloid-like news surrounding the tabloid publication. One of the things that we're hearing, Rick, is that Ron Burkle, who is an investor, owns a number of prominent different companies, has been a major Democratic donor, that he might be in talks to acquire us. Does that surprise you?
Well, yes and no. I'm not too good at speculating, but somebody did ask me this morning who would buy it, and my answer was, well, maybe an individual we aren't thinking of, and he really fits that pattern. I don't think it's a good investment for, you know, kind of a respectable company like Meredith. But individual may come in and think he can do something with it that the current ownership hasn't and make a fresh start. And, of course, as you and your listeners know better than I do, Mr. Burkle has a lot of background in supermarkets. I'm not sure whether he still owns some or the chain that he did. That's where he made his largest sum of money. So, you know, he's got a kind of a couple of connections there. And the New York Times story about this about an hour ago noted that he's fairly close to Trump, too. And, of course, he was a good buddy of Bill Clinton's for a number of years. So he's kind of got that profile of somebody who likes to be close to the action, and having a publication of your own gets you that.
Wouldn't it be ironic if Jeff Bezos ended up buying it?
It'd be more than ironic. I'm sure he wouldn't go there.
Yeah, that would be extraordinary. We're talking with Rick Edmonds of the Poynter Institute, the National Enquirer, apparently on the block to be sold. The question is, what kind of a future does a publication like that have? You know, so much of this of the kind of tabloid stories are out there in social media now. TMZ devoted, as one of our listeners pointed out, largely to celebrity news, but that has been the bread and butter for publications like, you know, The Globe and The National Enquirer over the years. And the question is, does it have a future, you know, with readers? Rick, thanks so much. I really appreciate your being with us and sharing your thoughts about the future of the publication.
Yeah, always good to be with you, Larry. Thank you.
Rick Edmonds of Poynter Institute joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, the closure of a neighborhood bar in the Los Feliz area, which interestingly was a bar that paid tribute to a beloved downtown Los Angeles bar that really gave a sense of L.A. history and closed its doors. I want to open up the phone for you. You want to pay tribute to a favorite bar that closed its doors that was quintessentially Los Angeles? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'm going to pay my tribute to the long-lost Yimmy Lu Bar coming up. The bar that's closing was paying tribute to it, too. It's Air Talk on 89.3. Back in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Bars come and go. They close, just like restaurants. But Los Angeles has been home over the years to some wonderful bars that really pay tribute to the city, that epitomize Los Angeles. Sometimes it's darker elements. Sometimes it's very glossy Hollywoodization. I'd like to hear from you about your favorite, maybe a bar that you felt really captured the city but is gone. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We got word that a Los Feliz institution, the Good Luck Bar, which itself was paying tribute to an earlier L.A. bar, is closing. The bar next to the Vista Theater in the Los Feliz District. Joining us is Elena Shatkin, KPCC, an LAist food editor. Elena, the bar closing after more than a couple of decades.
Yeah, about 25 years, and it seems to have really struck a nerve with people. I think that's because in the last few years, we have lost a lot of these kind of older bars. I don't know if I want to say old because it's not like they've been around for hundreds of years, but right, decades. We Piano Bar, Smog Cutter, El Chavo, also restaurants like Cha 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 and Mexico City have closed. TG and Atwater was closed for a while as it went through new ownership and then got a revamp. So I think a lot of people in, you know, the Los Feliz, Silver Lake, Echo Park, Atwater areas, and, you know, also probably like, you know, Highland Park, those kind of areas are like, hey, these are my kind of classic old school neighborhood bars, and they're being replaced with glossier, more upscale, probably more expensive versions of those bars.
Well, I was going to say, and sometimes the bars, I won't name any names, but get purchased and so changed that they lose what kind of made them
Formosa Cafe
colorful places in the past. And
yeah,
it's just not the same vibe.
Yeah, I think people like those places. I mean, the truth is, I think there aren't always a ton of those places in Los Angeles. So when we do find those little niche spots that we feel at home in, then, you know, we want them to stick around.
Hedy Lynn Hurdy's actually has a contribution to make the Lost Night, K-N-I-G-H-T, on Sunset in Echo Park. It sounds like that's still open, though. So we're, you know, I'd love to hear from little places that, you know, didn't quite make it. Now, the Yimmy Lou Bar in Chinatown, if anybody went there, there was nothing else like it. It was attached to a Chinese restaurant that had a basement that you'd always see people coming into Yimmy Lou, the restaurant, going down into the basement. You never knew what was going on down there, coming and going. And in the bar, it was the widest selection of Angelenos. You'd see, you know, grandmothers in there with, you know, younger people. You didn't know how they supported themselves. The you know, reddish tint of the lighting, the great jukebox attached to the wall playing everything from rockabilly to oldies to, I mean, just all kinds of stuff. That was a place that didn't make it because the building was earthquake damaged. They couldn't restore it. But the bar that's closing was paying tribute to that in many ways.
Yeah, it was. Yimmy Lou's closed in 1989, and I believe that spot was turned into a strip mall. It's a little before my time in Los Angeles, but yeah, they...
You missed out.
Yeah, but the Good Luck Bar was definitely, you know, paying tribute to that kind of bar, that style, and that particular bar.
All right. Oh, and Hedy said it has been closed for your Lost Night is lost. Sad to hear that. Roseanne in Venice. Which neighborhood place do you want to lament?
I want to lament Howell's Bar and Grill. Howell's Bar and Grill was there for decades.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize it closed.
Americans to own a restaurant here on Abbot Kinney. They ended up doubling his rent, and literally he had to leave the neighborhood. He opened up a little small place. It never really worked, but I got to tell you, this place was always packed. Sunday night was jazz. Monday night was football. Tuesday night was ham. Wow. Rice wine, and the food was fantastic.
And Abbot Kinney, of course, has become, it's just totally transformed.
Yeah, I mean, another bar that I love on that stretch that closed was Roosterfish, which was another great place.
All right. Roseanne, thank you. Brendan in Northeast L.A., which closed bar do you lament?
Well, the one I would like to remember when I was a kid, when I was a kid, well, I was about 18 or 19, I started going there. It was a place called Al's Bar in downtown L.A. It was on Traction and Third. It was a punk rock bar, total gritty dive place. It represents that element of L.A. that you don't really see around a whole lot anymore. But we loved it. The place was covered in graffiti. It looked like L.A.'s version of CBGB's, and we had a lot of fun there. There were only two types of beer, and you could smoke in there. People did drugs. You know, it was a crazy part of L.A., but it was a... In my opinion, like a lot of great bands that, you know, came up in the punk scene that made a name for themselves played there, and it's just...
Yeah, I love your comparison, CBGB, because it was known outside of Los Angeles for just the reasons you describe, being central to the punk scene here. Brendan, thanks so much. Terry in Studio City also wanted to bring up memories of Al's Bar. Steve in Westwood, which bar you said closed its doors?
It was the Liquid Kitty on Pico. It had been there for a few decades. Martini bar, dark, a little bit dank, kind of friendly, but kind of not. And their signature drink was called the Liquid Kitty. It was a stiff martini served with a Camel, unfiltered Camel cigarette as a garnish.
I know. I love that place and Al's Bar. Both of those are great, such great classic neighborhood LA bars.
Monica in San Pedro says, I got married at Yimi Lu on Ord Street. It was great. I went there for years, met so many great people. Sad that it's gone now. Monica, I love that she got married there. What a talk about a colorful place to exchange your vows. You can also share your favorite long gone neighborhood bars, dive bars, places that were truly LA on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Tara writes, you can add everything in Highland Park to the list, not just the bars, the liquor stores, too. Many neighborhood institutions are gone. Lucy Furr said, Edna Earle's Fog Cutter, a place that closed its doors, long gone. Elena, thanks. Any a place or two you want to add before we conclude?
Well, I was a big fan of a place in downtown L.A. years ago called it was a very divey bar at the base of the Hotel Stillwell. It still exists, but it's been revamped, I understand. And my band and I would practice a few blocks away in a storefront where one of my band members wasn't supposed to be living. And then we'd go over to this bar in the Stillwell and we would drink and we would be the only people there except for a couple of a couple of winos and the occasional random weirdo like us.
That's great. Thank you, Elena. Appreciate it so much. As we remember quintessential L.A. bars that have closed their doors with news that Los Feliz's The Good Luck Bar is closing down after 25 years of serving drinks. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to talk about the rising number of physical attacks on employees of hospital emergency rooms. An extraordinary percentage of ER physicians and nurses report they've been subjected to physical attacks from the people that they're trying to help. We're going to talk about whether medical schools, nursing programs, whether they're preparing or whether they are equipped to prepare future ER employees with some of the physical challenges they may be facing. Also, of course, the question about whether healthcare facilities are doing enough to provide for the protection of those working in those facilities. Also, during the course of this hour, as we think it might be appropriate, we'll probably be dipping into some of the memorial for rapper and entrepreneur Nipsey Hussle. His memorial is underway at Staples Center in downtown Los Angeles. In fact, let's just get just a little sense of what's going on. This pastor, Shep Crawford, Grammy Award winning. Oh, he just left the stage. We're going to have another person coming up shortly, and we'll see if we can dip in and give you a little sense of the presentations that are being made to memorialize Nipsey Hussle downtown. But first, with us, UCLA professor, constitutional law scholar Eugene Volokh. He joins us frequently to talk about freedom of speech, First Amendment issues. He has a First Amendment clinic, in fact, free speech clinic at UCLA. And he's prepared a series of videos aimed at students through high school about free speech, the free speech rules, the new video series. This is from episode one, Seven Things You Should Know About Free Speech in Schools.
Students from first grade to 12th can't be punished based on their political or religious speech. As the Supreme Court said in the Tinker case, it can hardly be argued that students shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. This protects, for instance, wearing black armbands to protest a war, distributing religious messages to classmates between classes, or criticizing a teacher over lunch. 2. Schools can punish speech that materially disrupts schoolwork, for instance, because it prompts fights. That's why lower courts have let schools ban clothing that displays Confederate flags, and in one case, even clothing that displays an American flag on Cinco de Mayo when that display led to violence. That's a kind of heckler's veto, where threats against the speaker are used by the government to justify restricting the speaker rather than the threateners. Usually the government can't impose such a heckler's veto, but the rule in schools seems to be different. That may not seem right to you, but I don't make the law, I just make videos about it.
And animation underscores the points that are included in it. Professor Volokh, good to have you with us to talk about this series. Was the Schoolhouse Rock or those sorts of videos kind of inspiration for this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And a bunch of other videos recently that are visual. We try to, in the videos, have a lot of graphics, have something that catches the eye. We don't have songs. Schoolhouse Rock, of course, is famous for its songs. Wish we could, don't have the talent. But the goal is to make it fun and interesting to learn real substance about this. Our goal here is not to promote any particular ideas. It's just to be an honest broker in explaining what the rules are, whether you like them or not.
And to do that, to make sure that this is straightforward and you're not going to be accused of putting this in one side or the other, are you using court precedent as a way of explaining sort of what the limitations and freedoms are?
That's right. Absolutely. We refer to particular Supreme Court cases. I'm actually planning to, on our site, we have a website, freespeechrules.com, which links to the videos, plan to have not just the scripts of them available, but also citations and links to particular cases. Like if you don't agree with us, with our statement of the law, well, look up the cases. You'll see it yourself. So I think there's a hunger among many children, college kids, adults too. It's accessible, I think, to everybody to get a real sense of what are the rules. There are rules of free speech law. It's not just about the rules. Of course, if you're arguing in the Supreme Court, you could be arguing about big picture policy questions. But here, we just want to explain what the rules are that you can apply when you hear something in the news. You'd say, oh, now I know how the court is likely to decide or why a court decided the way it did.
Well, in your experience, we've talked about so many of these issues. It seems like schools and districts are often unclear on First Amendment law, even though they have, their own legal counsel available to them. Why do you think that so often with districts or schools, they don't seem to be aware of, their limits in terms of controlling students?
Because they haven't watched our videos. But no, really, I think it's in large part because often school officials have to make a decision, sometimes on the spot, sometimes under a lot of pressure, and they don't really think things through. Unfortunately, that's not uncommon. You have businesses in a lot of areas that make what in retrospect seem like pretty foolish legal choices, but they haven't thought it through. I doubt that there are a lot of schools out there who say, yeah, we know what the law is, we just don't care. It's just that they're not primarily lawyers. They sometimes don't ask their lawyers, and sometimes their lawyers may not really be fully on top of things. So, this happens. A law is never perfectly enforced, whether it's First Amendment law or Fourth Amendment law or criminal law or anything else. We wish there would be more compliance, that people would follow the law more, but sometimes they don't. They're people.
We're talking with UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. We're talking about the series of animated videos he's put together to educate kids about their freedom of speech, about First Amendment issues. You have questions for him about the law, about issues that may be played out when you were in school or with your kids in school, about freedom of expression, from what they can wear to school, comments they can make about teachers or administrators, about political speech on campus. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can also comment on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're most familiar with, conflicts over this playing out at colleges and universities, but do you get contacted about issues at high schools where this comes into play?
Yes, that's right. I often hear about them. I sometimes blog about them. I should say our first video was has on free speech in K through 12 schools. We have others. Our second one that we put out was on hate speech, more broadly, not in the school context. The third one just came out yesterday, was on fake news. The one right now coming up is on the right of publicity and life story rights. We're going to have one on Alexander Hamilton and the freedom of the press. It turns out he was very influential in early American free press law. Didn't make its way into its musical, but it's going to be in our videos.
We're talking with UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. Let's right now listen in. This is a letter from President Obama sent to the attendees, Nipsey Hussle's memorial.
And his community work. While most folks look at the Crenshaw neighborhood where he grew up and only see gangs, bullets, and despair, Nipsey saw potential. He saw hope. He saw a community that even through its flaws taught him to always keep going. His choice to invest in that community, rather than to ignore it, to build a skills training center, a co-working space in Crenshaw, to lift up the Eritrean American community. He set an example for young people to follow and is a legacy worth of celebration. I hope his memory inspires more good work in Crenshaw and communities like it. Michelle and I send our sympathies to Lauren, Imani Cross, and his whole family, and to all those who love Nipsey. Sincerely, Barack Obama.
Letter from President Obama to the mourners who were gathered at Staples Center to pay tribute to rapper and entrepreneur Nipsey Hussle. Karen Civil, who just read that letter, a digital media marketing strategist who helped create the WeezyThanksYou.com website. The rapper Lil Wayne wrote letters to his fans while he was in prison at Rikers Island using that website. So she was there to read that letter from President Obama and Michelle Obama. We'll give you just drop-ins throughout the course of the hour to the memorial taking place at Staples for Nipsey Hussle. Again, if you want to talk with First Amendment constitutional law specialist from UCLA, Eugene Volokh, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We've had a number of incidents where on college campuses, protesters have gotten up, disrupted speeches. A colleague of yours, in fact, recently had his talk interrupted at the University of Chicago. Law professor who was up speaking about the BDS disinvestment movement with Israel, and people were arrested there. What does the Constitution say about disrupting public speech?
Disruptions of public speech are not constitutionally protected. If you want to express your views critical of a speaker, you certainly can, maybe on the sidewalks outside of the building. You can organize your own event, but you can't shout down, physically shout down the speaker so that he's unable to speak. There was a prosecution some years ago at UC Irvine where there were some protesters who essentially stopped an Israeli ambassador from speaking at UC Irvine, and they were prosecuted and convicted. I think many universities set things up so that people can ask questions, including critical questions during Q&A. That's certainly something that's a good idea to have. And again, they could leaflet and they could organize their own events. There usually are at universities events on all sides of an issue. But shouting someone down so they can't be heard, that's not protected. If you really want to have a technical legal discussion, there are permissible content-neutral restrictions that say you can't shout someone down. They're allowed because they serve important interests in making sure that people can be heard, and they leave open ample alternative channels for communication. So that's the legal rule. But the basic principle is you can speak at a time that's set up for your event, but you can't speak in a way that suppresses the speech at another event.
Eugene, what about security costs? This has been a controversial thing, again, on campuses where certain groups who bring in outside speakers have been socked with, very high bills to provide security because of concerns over violence at those events. what is the right of the college or university to pass on some of or all of those expenses to those sponsors?
That's a great question, and it's a difficult question. When it comes to private universities are not bound by the First Amendment. So they could just say, you know, we don't want any speakers, even based on viewpoint. It's bad kind of professional ethics, I think, but it's not unconstitutional. When it comes to the government, if the government is trying to restrict, say, a parade on a city street or a rally in a public park by saying you have to pay a lot of money in order to get a permit because we're afraid that people might come in and attack you, so you need security costs, that's considered unconstitutional. There's a case on that called Forsyth County v. Nationalist Movement, where the court said that would essentially be a kind of heckler's veto, that would be a way in which protesters or opponents of yours, by threatening attacks, can essentially silence you. One question is, does the same thing apply when the government is dealing with its own specialized property, like a public university like UCLA or UC Berkeley, or does it only apply to public streets and public sidewalks, so-called traditional public forums? And there's some case law that suggests that, yes, the same principle applies at a public university. So once the government opens up certain spaces for speech, it can't then say, but we'll charge you a lot of money if your speech is highly unpopular, essentially. That would be an impermissible discrimination against unpopular viewpoints. This having been said, I totally understand that many universities say we'd rather spend this money on other things than security.
Thousands of dollars.
But the other thing is behavior that's rewarded gets repeated. If people know that all they need to do is threaten violence and then some speaker they dislike is going to be ejected or is going to be essentially prevented from coming, then you're going to see more violence and more threats of violence.
We're talking with UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. Joining us, Eva in Venice, your question about expression on campus.
My question is T-shirts. I've read several articles saying that there are kids in high school campuses where they're allowed to have, you know, like free speech kind of a day. But when they wear like a MAGA T-shirt, they're immediately told to go home or even suspended. And I found that problematic, but nobody else seemed to at the schools. And this was high schools across the nation, several of them.
Yeah, Eva, thanks very much.
There's actually a good deal of case law on the subject. The general rule is, if the school allows T-shirts, so it doesn't have a uniform policy, that's a separate thing if it has a uniform policy. But if it allows students to wear T-shirts with whatever messages they want, generally speaking, it can't then say, well, but this message is offensive. This message is insulting to some people or something like that. If it can show that there's a real risk of disruption, of fights, of violence, of something like that, then it can indeed say, look, you have to take this shirt off or turn it inside out or cover it up or whatever else. Now, some people don't even like that. They say, you know, that's a form of heckler's veto, too. That shouldn't be allowed. But in fact, the courts have said, yes, that could be allowed, but only if you really do have evidence that there'll be fights or something along those lines from that. Simply the fact that some people don't like it or some people are offended or might be offended, that's not a permissible basis. There have been a few cases recently, actually, involving T-shirts that are pro-gun rights. And sometimes schools have said, no, we have a rule that says you cannot depict any weapons on a T-shirt. And the courts have said, no, that's unconstitutional because if you want to have a T-shirt that shows a Minuteman and talking about praising American history or shows a gun in the context of supporting the National Rifle Association or a lot of other contexts, too, shows guns in the context of opposing guns, that is constitutionally protected speech.
Interesting. So the image itself couldn't be considered inflammatory. What about private schools? If you have, for example, let's say a Christian school where a student wears a shirt in favor of abortion rights that runs contrary to the school's, you know, theological position, because it's private, can they set whatever rules they want?
So it's a little complicated. Generally speaking, the First Amendment doesn't apply to private institutions. The first word of the First Amendment is Congress. So the federal government can't do things. That's been applied through the 14th Amendment to states and local governments. But private entities aren't constrained by that. In California, though, there is a statute that limits private high schools. and applies pretty much the same First Amendment rule to private high schools, but not religious schools. The theory being religious schools should be able to set up create their own environment with their own speech restrictions. That may be, in fact, part of why people send their kids to religious school. But secular high schools, private schools, are governed in California under the statute by pretty much the same rules as apply to public high schools. In fact, actually, under California law, both public and private high schools actually are even more constrained than they are by the First Amendment. So, in fact, in California, even T-shirts that might potentially lead to fights or something like that, even those would be protected by the law, even if they aren't by the First Amendment.
We're talking with UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. He has written a series of animated videos that are aimed at educating particularly students, but the general public on the First Amendment, on free speech. The videos are at freespeechrules.com. I did want to ask you about hate speech, because this is probably the most controversial area of all, where colleges and universities are trying to weigh feelings of students being safe, feeling accepted on campus, versus the rights of individuals to say what, you know, the overwhelming majority of us may think are heinous things about groups of people. What does the Constitution say about that?
Well, this is one area where the Supreme Court has been quite clear that the government can't discriminate based on viewpoint, even against horrible viewpoints, even against viewpoints that back violent revolution or viewpoints that back racial hatred or religious hatred or whatever else. The most recent case was actually a case where all the government tried to do is deny a trademark registration. Terms that it thought were racially offensive. And the court unanimously said that's unconstitutional. Now, in that case, it was an Asian-American band called the Slants. They were trying to use this term, which has historically been a slur against Asians, but trying to reclaim it in a positive way. But the Supreme Court, its logic would have equally applied to racially hostile users of trademarks. It was quite obvious to the justices that would be so. And the court said, no, the First Amendment protects that speech. Again, the government wasn't even trying to outlaw it. It was just saying we're going to deny this trademark law benefit to it. Court said no. So I think the same thing is quite clear when it comes to public universities. The public universities can't suppress speech on the grounds that it expresses viewpoints that they think is hateful.
So it would have to find other ways to provide those students who feel threatened by that speech a sense of security on campus.
Well, so I think if the speech really is something that is potentially intimidating, then certainly the university can speak up and say, look, we will protect you. If anybody really does want to act violently, then in that case, that should be that will be stopped. I'll give you an example of a hate speech I saw on a bumper sticker driving through Brentwood, a pretty rich part of town. Somebody had this bumper sticker that said, guillotine the 1%. You know, literally, that's a call for mass murder. Now, maybe people will say, well, that's hyperbole, that's exaggeration, that's figurative, but that's true of a lot of kinds of hate speech. But that's fully constitutionally protected. If it was said at UCLA, I think that it would make sense for the university to say, look, killing, political killing is impermissible, obviously illegal. And if anybody actually tries to act violently against people they see as oppressors or whatever else, we're going to protect those people. But the speech is protected. In other situations, I think the proper response is to say, look, you should come up with arguments about this. So some people, for example, view criticism of transgender rights as hate speech. Well, it's an interesting debate. How should the law deal with transgender people? In fact, right now, there is no federal statute, for example, protecting transgender people from discrimination. Maybe there should be, maybe there shouldn't be. But there ought to be a discussion about this rather than just university trying to exclude, say, one view on that or one view on illegal aliens or one view on how to deal with militant Islam or for that matter, conservative Christianity. There should be all views like that expressed at university campuses.
Eugene, thank you for coming in, talking about the videos and about free speech. We appreciate it very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Appreciate it. UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh talking about the animated series Free Speech Rules. Three of the episodes, I think, are out right now, with more of them to be coming out. FreeSpeechRules.com, the website where they're available. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'll be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Police in South Carolina say a shooting inside a hospital has left a police officer and a suspected gunman injured. It's the second hospital shooting in South Carolina in 2 days. Tuesday, an armed man seeking mental health treatment was turned away from a medical center in Orangeburg, South Carolina. The man was disarmed. His girlfriend was told to bring the man back tomorrow for treatment, but instead the man showed up yesterday with a gun, opened fire in the emergency room, and critically injured a nurse. Well, these are prime examples of just what we were coincidentally planning to discuss today, and that is the increasing threats of physical violence to emergency room employees, to nurses, physicians, technicians, receptionists, people in emergency rooms who are dealing with ever angrier and sometimes physically violent patients, the very people that the employees are trying to help. Now, just last year, a poll of emergency room physicians found nearly half reported being physically assaulted while they were at work. And of those who reported being physically assaulted, more than 60% said that the assaults had happened within the past year. Joining us to talk about whether this is discussed in medical school, in nursing school, what hospitals are doing to try and deal with this, is emergency room physician from the Baltimore area, Lee Vinoker, who's an expert on violence in the ER. Dr. Vinoker, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So have you seen that these incidents have increased in the past several years?
Yes, absolutely. You know, this poll just corroborated what my colleagues and friends have noticed has been going on and appears to be escalating. But it's a problem that's always there. And, you know, the healthcare setting and the emergency department especially is the perfect recipe or storm to have this happen, because, you know, it's a very emotionally volatile experience for people. They're at their worst. They're the most vulnerable. They're frightened. Their family members are frightened and stressed out, and often people lash out. In the ER, we also deal with a lot of these problems. I always say it's a microcosm of society, because gun violence, gang violence, domestic violence, the prevalence of severe psychiatric disorders, lack of places and behavioral health care beds for them, it all kind of spills into the ER. So it is a very common problem. And as you said, a majority of our physicians that were polled at the American College of Emergency Physicians felt very fearful that this is perhaps escalating, and they worry about it when they come to work.
So this South Carolina, these pair of incidents over the past couple of days, sort of within, I mean, they're particularly violent experiences. We have a nurse in critical condition after being shot, but certainly this not an isolated incident. Also with us from UCLA's Department of Medicine, a senior clinical quality specialist, Anna Dermenschen, who has written and spoken about violence involving nurses. Thank you very much for being with us, Anna. Is this something that's included in nurses' training, in medical school? Do they get any preparation for the potential of being attacked when they're working?
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having me on the show. Our education in nursing school, as well as medicine, really focuses on a lot of clinical topics. There are some classes where they invite, it's not directly part of the curriculum, but they do invite guest speakers, guest speakers to come and speak about de-escalation techniques and specific populations of patients, such as the psychiatric units or emergency departments that have more frequent incidents like this. But it is targeted more on general education, focused on de-escalation techniques and prevention. It doesn't go into the reality of what we see in our healthcare system, the rise of violence, and how we have to be more aware and trained before we start positions in the hospital.
And in hospitals themselves, I don't know whether UCLA Medical Center or others where, you know, you're sending nurses out of your program at UCLA, are they recognizing they've got to come up with very specific protocols and training procedures for staff?
Yes, I work in a health system and in a state that has a requirement for organizations to have education for their staff, and nurses are required to take a course online, a workplace violence prevention course. It's every 2 years, and it's different modules. It's very interactive, but it talks about being more aware, knowing what prevention looks like, the specific techniques of de-escalation, having a reporting system, knowing how to report, because surveys have found that most nurses don't report incidents. Only 20, maybe 20 to 40% actually report, where then it goes through a chain of command and people look to see what the root causes are.
We're going to continue our conversation. I'd love to hear from you if you are a healthcare professional who's experienced violence either in the emergency room or in an inpatient or outpatient facility, a clinic where you work. Also, what in recent years have been perhaps new protocols where you work implemented to deal with potential violence on the scene where you provide medical care? So we're talking to nurses, to technicians with different specialties, to physicians. 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're going to get a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. The memorial for rapper entrepreneur Nipsey Hussle is underway at Staples Center. Father Thomas Ewell, pastor, is reading from scripture on the stage at Staples Center right now. Capacity crowd of mourners are there. The stage where Father Ewell is speaking is completely bedecked in flowers. There are sprays of them there, risers that are there for musical performers. In fact, Anthony Hamilton with an impassioned Do You Feel Me just performed several minutes ago. There are tributes that are scheduled for children coming up. There'll be an obituary and eulogy. If we get an opportunity, something we feel is appropriate to drop in on and share with you, we'll do that during the course of the memorial over these next 20 minutes. What we're talking about right now is the threat and real physical violence that hospital employees face, whether we're talking about nurses, technicians, receptionists, security personnel, physicians. All of them, you know, potentially vulnerable position in emergency rooms or inpatient or outpatient facilities where care's been provided and where patients can turn on the employees there. Is enough being done with hospitals? What about the training programs, medical schools and the like, to help prepare people for something you just you know, are not thinking about when you're trying to deal with a crush of individuals needing health care in facilities today. We're talking with UCLA School of Nursing Senior Clinical Quality Specialist Anna Dermenschen and Lee Vinoker, who's an emergency room physician in the Baltimore area. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Molly in Culver City, I understand you're a volunteer at an ER in the greater Los Angeles area, but what do you see going on?
Hi, thanks for having me. We often encounter irate patients, and we're typically the first person they see when they walk into the emergency room before triage. And we get a lot of angry patients, and there is no training for us at all.
So you just have to keep your wits about you and figure out how to get a handle on the situation. What have you learned certain techniques over your time as a volunteer to try and de-escalate things?
Well, we typically, I've found that it's safest to just, you know, be firm and polite and, you know, try to extract yourself from the situation as soon as possible, because they haven't really trained us at all on how to deal with it. You follow the chain of command in the sense of, well, I'm not a doctor, but I can get your nurse and help you. But it's difficult because I'm a small woman and many of these patients are angry and quite larger than me.
Yeah. And what would you like to see at the medical center where you volunteer? What would you like to see them do to better prepare you as well as the paid staff?
Well, I do have to say there is a lot of security, but they sit at the back of the, you know, front lobby. So it'd be nice to see someone right in front. So I guess kind of, you know, almost as an emergency room bouncer. But, you know, the nursing staff sits behind a bulletproof glass. You know, we're just standing there. So I guess it'd be nice to feel safer or to receive some sort of training on how to handle difficult situations like that.
Have you ever thought of stopping your volunteering because of vulnerability, or you feel like that's just that you're committed enough, that's not going to dissuade you?
It wouldn't dissuade me. I mean, I think anyone can argue that you're at risk regardless of where you are in the world. So I don't want to stop doing what I'm doing because I do really enjoy volunteering.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Molly, and also so nice that you are making that contribution at your local hospital. Molly in Culver City, we're at 866-893-KPCC. If you work in or volunteer in an emergency room, in a hospital, in a clinic, and you've had to deal with escalating threats or violence, what would you like to see your institution do that maybe isn't being provided? What have they implemented that you applaud, you think is making a difference? If you're someone who's actually had to face some sort of a physical attack while providing medical care, I'd like to hear you share a bit about your experience and what you learned from it, the extent of it, and what you think would be an effective way of either providing precautions or ways of, in the moment, dealing with it. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Dr. Vinoker, what are some of the approaches that seem to be effective for medical personnel to use against someone threatening violence?
Yes, well, and Molly brings up a good point. So, you know, as far as the staff and a lot of big health systems now, in my health system prior, we did have this violence prevention committee, and we did create programming. We have disaster planning where we might have training of an active shooter and what to do. So usually when that's happening in the emergency departments, they're also working with everybody within the emergency department, including things like advocates and volunteers. So certainly those health systems should have some training classes. Almost everyone that came into our health system, even as a volunteer, there were certain training modules that they had to go over that talked about workplace violence. But I think it is a newer phenomenon. It certainly wasn't training when I went through training and residency, and I myself had an incident where I was choked by a patient in the emergency department in a city. So it's very important. And de-escalation is one of the things, but also emergency rooms are very hectic areas. So constant communication. Some people just are getting frustrated. They're frightened. You know, they're not hearing from their doctor. Their doctor might be seeing, you know, 20 patients in the ER. Their nurses might have five. Their techs. And there is a statistic that shows, you know, the closer you are to the point patient, the more you see them and the more you get lashed out against. So just constantly letting the patient know, you know, we're waiting for this test or we're waiting for a bed here or those kinds of open communication. And then certainly if you see something escalating, there are training programs for de-escalating. But Anna was right. Even in our survey, nearly half of those that were injured did not report, because as healthcare workers, we all go into healthcare because of compassion for our patients. We understand if they're ill or impaired and they're acting out that it's could be the illness or the impairment, and we don't want to sort of further stigmatize them. Right. But I think at this point, hospitals are getting to the point where they are saying they might have to press charges.
Hey, before I take another call, just real briefly, after you were choked, was it hard for you to go back to work? Or, I mean, that's obviously a traumatic event.
Yeah, it was pretty traumatic. It was a patient that was under opioid addiction. Not all. We gave Narcan in the ER, which abruptly woke him up. He was very angry. We ruined his high. It was before the time that the police would administer that on the street. And everyone kind of scattered. He grabbed me. Luckily, somebody came from behind and got him into a chokehold so I could pry him off of my neck. It did cut my neck and rip jewelry off. So I never wore jewelry again to the ER after that, like necklace. But, you know, it was hard. It was hard and it was frightening, but, you know, it still was few and far between. And I remember so many more incidents of patients and family members thanking me. Yeah. And, you know, as a healthcare provider, you do understand if somebody is in an impaired condition, it's not always necessarily them. It could be the condition that you have to deal with.
We're talking with emergency room physician Lee Vanocur, expert on violence in the emergency room. George in Pasadena says, I'm a psychiatric emergency nurse. This has been happening for so long. We tried to get a law passed in California that would make it a felony if a patient hits a nurse, but the bill didn't end up going anywhere. Natalie in Santa Monica, good to have you with us. Your experience, I understand you're a psychiatrist.
I am a psychiatrist. I've worked in the hospitals my entire 20-year career.
And how frequently have you had to deal with either threats of physical assault or actual attack?
I think the threat of physical assault is pretty much daily, but I've actually been physically assaulted 3 times.
Oh my goodness. And how have you dealt with that emotionally and the fears that would naturally raise?
You know, I think as providers, we're always talking to each other, sort of debriefing on a small scale and actually, I think when I did press charges against one of my patients, that actually was very therapeutic as well. That this is not acceptable.
Do you find that your colleagues are empathize with you or sympathetic, or that people didn't give this the weight that you felt it deserved?
I think that my peers, those of us who are down in the trenches, are very sympathetic and supportive, and that includes the nursing staff and mental health technicians, and also the security guards. those that are less sympathetic would be the hospital administrators who want these things to go away. And I actually did change one of my jobs because I wanted to be in an environment where I was supported and not discouraged from setting limits with patients.
Natalie, thank you for sharing that experience, and extraordinary that this is a daily occurrence, that you have threats of assault by the psychiatric patients with whom you work at hospitals. You're listening to Air Talk. Let's dip into the memorial service for Nipsey Hussle, performance by Jhené Aiko.
The more that I see, the more that I know, I don't know anything at all. The more that I breathe, it starts to go slow. Of all the many things I can only recall, all of the good things, good things, all of the good things, only the good, good, the good, only the good, good, the good, only the good things, all of the good things, only the good, good, the good, only the good. Living on Sycamore Street, spending weekends on the beach, we were free to be everything we dreamed. Banquets and water fights, summer nights we'd ride our bikes on Overhill, Madera.
Jhené Aiko paying tribute to Nipsey Hussle. That's live from Staples Center, a capacity crowd of mourners as they pay tribute to the rapper and entrepreneur. My apologies for interrupting the middle of our conversation about the physical vulnerability of emergency room employees in hospitals across the country. And I want to thank my guests, Dr. Lee Van Oker and Anna Dermenschen of UCLA in the nursing program there. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, KPCC's Austin Cross. He's inside Staples. He'll describe for us the scene. We'll be back in 1 minute. Right now, they're showing a home video of a very, very young Nipsey Hussle, a young man growing up in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, showing video of him doing a little bit of breakdancing as a kid, the floor of his Los Angeles home, on the front yard of where he grew up, remembering his life in Los Angeles, what his city meant to him, contributions that he made economically to his community, and of course the voice that he gave to the Crenshaw District of Southwest Los Angeles. Boy, he had some good moves, that little kid. Wow. All right. That's what's being shown right now on screen in Staples Center, the memorial for Nipsey Hussle. Inside the arena is KPCC Take Two producer Austin Cross. Austin, thanks so much. Give us a sense of what's been happening over the past 35 minutes or so of the memorial.
Sure, Larry. We're in a very somber mood here. We did hear some performances from Anthony Hamilton, and another lady joined as well. And it's just been a very touching experience. You walk in and you see a very big black and white picture of Nipsey Hussle, and below that, a lot of flowers. His casket is right there. And then they started off with a slideshow of his life and younger, and they played My Way by Frank Sinatra in the background, and it felt like church. To be honest, you could hear a pin drop. I know people say that phrase a lot, but I think that everybody who is here really grasps the gravity. They really respect the man, and you can just tell. You can just tell by how everybody is just taking it in and saying amen when the priest comes up, and you know, going along with the prayers. It's a very close event.
One thing I love is right now, as we're speaking, they're continuing to show the home videos of him as a kid. And again, you know, for those of you that know the Crenshaw District, you know the community around there. It's just everything so familiar, and seeing his the sense of place that his life presents of Los Angeles. Austin, you mentioned it's kind of somber. And I was wondering how much of it would be a celebratory sense of his life versus people's grief over the fact this young man, you know, lost so soon. What do we have coming up that's going to be celebrating him?
You know, to that point, Larry, it's definitely been a bit of a balance. At the beginning, they started off with the DJ playing his music. Everybody stood up, was cheering and clapping. And then there were some very touching and somber moments, too, when the family came out, and I believe it was his son ended up speaking.
I saw that.
About a dream that he had. So there is definitely a balance there.
All right. Hey, Austin, I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you so much, and I'm really glad you could be there and give us a sense of what's happening. KPCC producer, take two, Austin Cross in Staples, as Nipsey Hussle is being memorialized. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk. Have a good afternoon.